all CEOs, me included, we don't actually know what we're doing.
They're all sharks. So all you got to do, though, is know shark behavior.
I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
We can capture all of the wallet share.
First place you start is with the product.
That's just the first nut.
This is the Capital Stack.
Hey, everybody. This is David Paul, the host of the Capital Stack podcast, where I talk to founders, operators, and investors about all things value creation in startups. Today, I am talking to Krista Morgan, who is a general partner at the Stage Fund, where they give founders their second act. One of the greatest trade lines I've heard so far from a fund. I'm going to let Krista tell the story. Krista, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
This is the first time I'm doing this, but I'm like standing at my desk. Do you feel it?
I do.
I'm in a warrior pose.
I like it.
My shoes are off. I'm grounding. I feel aggressive right now. So, tell us a little bit about yourself. How'd you get into investing?
I got into it the way I think everyone gets into it, which is that I had a startup and I failed quite spectacularly and became an investor. Is that not everyone's story?
That's how I got in.
Those who can't do teach, is it like that?
Yeah. If you don't, like, I would say I'm the worst operator on the planet, but if you know, I'm really great at giving anecdotal advice.
Great. Yeah. So, I mean, all kidding aside, that is actually how I ended up. Wasn't quite that straight a line, but I got my degree. I grew up in Canada. That was great. I moved to London. I worked in advertising for some really cool brands. So I learned a lot about go-to-market strategy and people. And then I started a crowdfunding fintech platform that did great until it didn't. We had a giant issue in the portfolio and I had to figure out what I was going to do next. And I'd met my partner, Dan, along the way. And he said, he's like, you know what it is to go through a turnaround, figure out, you know, how to get out the other side. I understood how to manage people's money. And so that was it. And
then it worked.
It works. Yeah. Turns out this is what I was supposed to be doing all along. It just took me till I turned 40 to figure it out. Yeah.
And how long you been at Stage? Now?
Since 2020, so 4 years.
2020, okay.
Yeah.
And tell the audience about Stage Fund.
So we are a control investor, private equity investor, and we're making control acquisitions of early stage technology companies that are unable to raise more funding. And we take them off the venture track and try to put them on a new path forward, hence our second act tagline. So it's really, you get a second chance, right? Some new money, new capital structure, and really a new partner to help you figure out how we're going to make the company successful.
So founder raises money, founder whiffs, goes to investor for additional capital. They say, hey, we don't really have reserves anymore. You know, or we're in between funds. They kind of do that song and dance. And they say, why don't you try to raise outside capital? And founder goes for outside capital, doesn't hit the benchmarks that it needs to. And then how do they get in front of you?
Generally, surprisingly now, a lot more word of mouth. So turns out there are not very many people that do what we do. And so I talk to a lot of people and I always tell them, like, you don't want to have to call me, but you really want my number. It's just a useful phone number to have. So we got a lot of calls. And then most of our deal flow, call it the predictable deal flow, comes from lenders. So technology lenders that have been investing. So they've been lending alongside the VC capital. So they were just kind of underwriting to cash. And now all of a sudden there's no cash and they need a new equity sponsor in order
I don't think there's a worse asset class than venture debt.
It's a terrible, terrible asset class.
I'm no longer, but like, I just think it's a toxic asset class. That's yet to see its reckoning.
I mean, look, I think anytime you're, probably less so on the later stage tech lending, but certainly on the really early stage. Yeah. If you're underwriting to continued VC investment, especially in this market, I think in 2020 and 2021, it seemed like a good bet. And in this market, it just isn't.
Yeah. It's all great until it's not, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
And then, you know, everyone's your friend, everyone's your partner, and then they're not. And then things get pretty ugly pretty quick. So when the founder has your number and calls you, generally they're not excited. Their investors aren't excited. No one actually wants to talk to you, do they?
Well, I mean, I try to be a very kind, compassionate human and make it, you know, easy for people to talk to me. But look, I think it's true. No one wants to be in a situation where they're talking to us. But I think if you're a founder and you put, call it usually 5-6 years of blood, sweat, and tears into something, and often they feel like their investors have kind of let them down, whether that's true or not, that's often a story that they're telling themselves. And they, you know, they just want someone, they want a chance to keep going. And so sure, they, you know, they wish they weren't having the conversation with me at all. But if we're able to come in and give and actually make an investment, we're giving them an alternative that they just don't have, that's better than shutting it down.
And so how hard is it to get a deal done?
What does it look like? That's a right? good question.
You totally have misaligned incentives, right, at that point.
Right. Generally, if for us to get a deal done, we're coming in because both the lender, someone's forcing the issue. The lender's forcing the issue, the founder's forcing the issue. And sometimes even the investors are like, look, I want this portfolio company to stop calling me because I don't want to have to keep telling them that they're never getting money. And right. I want it off the books. So if they're coming to us to, if everyone is at a place where they have accepted that this is they've got to do a hard transaction, then transactions can get done in a fairly straightforward way. You're just arguing about who's paying for what. You have all these liabilities that people want covered, and you figure out what's the priority. How do you, you know, what are we willing to cover? What are we not? How much ownership are we getting on the other side? What's the new, we're really negotiating the new cap table and the new waterfall structure. And so, but I would say the number of calls I get where people think they're at that place of getting a hard deal done, but actually being there are two very different things.
Yeah. Is it because like they just don't have, like the investor's like, I don't think we're at there yet. Right. Like,
correct. It's amazing how you're like, okay, we're out, we're not going to fund this company. And then they're like, oh, but I don't want Stage to just have it for nothing. If they're willing, I guess it's amazing. As soon as you put an LOI on the table, everyone's like, oh, wait, there's an LOI. Maybe we could get a slightly better LOI. Maybe right. we can. And so, and then they're like, could I get a better, not great deal, if that makes sense?
Can I get a less worse deal than this?
Right. Can I get a less worse? Which, and honestly, the answer is usually no. Yeah. Funny enough, like the answer is usually no.
I am the grim reaper. Like, when you see me?
It's so funny you say that. I went to a startup event a couple of years ago and I was like, I'm never doing this again. Cause I did I said to someone, I was like, I'm the grim reaper of startups here. Like, I can't show up.
I'm not welcome here. Like, you're like, I buy by the pound.
Right? Yeah. I was like, no one wants. I'm like the only investor in the room no one wants to talk to. It's like I have the opposite problem of every other investor.
So like, so what's a good deal look like? I mean, obviously you're not going to take something that's absolute dog shit.
Try not to.
I mean, there's gotta be some value there because you raise capital and you're returning money to LPs. So how do you think about what's actually valuable in a company?
I think twofold. One is we really do look at how much capital has been invested to date and where do we think the value is created? You know, do they have a solid product? Do they have really good customers? Just where are they in the market? And do we think that given more time and maybe some incremental capital that they could actually keep growing? We also really care about the unit economics. So we've seen some companies where they are fundamentally unprofitable and no amount of There is no path to profitability. That definitely
right.
happens.
Yeah, like a high churn business, right? Like there's just, you know, you have to grow so fast to mitigate the churn. It's just, it's a capital incinerator.
Correct. So we're looking at that. And then a lot of it is just, what does the actual deal look like? Sometimes we really like something, but we just cannot get to terms, right? Because we have criteria. We have to be in control. We need to have a good preference on our capital. We need there to be downside protection. And sometimes you can't get there. And you can't get there in time. And everyone drags it out so long that the company's out of cash. And then all of a sudden the asset is actually like these assets can start to deteriorate pretty quickly. So there's a lot of timing.
Yeah. But yeah, you kind of have to be there at the right time before everyone that like actually is important leaves, right?
Yes. Because
they stop getting paid.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're generally not providing any cash in your transactions. You're saying, hey, we're going to take over. We're going to give you a slice of the NewCo, but we're going to fund cash into the balance sheet to actually correct it.
Correct. I would say we don't tend to put secondary cash, right? There's not really investor buyout. There is often cash to lenders. There is cash to vendors. There is cash to call it. It's like other liability holders that are critical.
Yes. Top of the stack.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. Right. Top of the stack cash is where, and probably more the longer we've been doing this for 4 years, we're raising our third fund. As we get into our third fund, I'm actually raising a larger fund so that we can do more of a buyout up front of the debt. Because in the early funds, we didn't have a lot of capital. So we just absorbed a lot of liability. And if we can pay for them up front, though, we can just get a discount. Basically say, we're going to buy this debt. There's $8 million of debt here for $4 million. It's out versus in our current deal structures, we just have to absorb that whole $8 million.
So is that the number, like a 50% discount if you're able to take it off the bank's balance sheet?
I think so. I mean, it depends on the situation, but often.
I would think you'd get a better deal, right?
It kind of depends. It depends where, how confident they are.
Yeah. Are the banks like workout teams? Like, are they good? Like, can they turn these things around? Or not, they don't really turn them. They just try to like put them on an auction block. How does a bank repo a company?
Well, that's, I think, the problem is like the bank is usually underwritten this to say, surely this is worth 1x revenue. That's, we get a lot of that, right?
Right.
Early stage tech companies we should get 1 to 2x revenue. I'm like, sure. In a liquid market where there's, you know, people are really looking for assets, fine. But today's market, you cannot count on 1 to 2x revenue. And so, yeah, the banks are, but they want to just show they've done their diligence of putting it out. The problem is then you're dealing with, you know, your failed process, then the deal's just getting worse too. So
because you have the natural decay of the deal, right?
Correct.
That's kind of happening.
Yeah.
And then like how many times, because you're on like fund four, like you know, I know that you guys have got great returns. My old partner is a partner with you guys. So how often in your portfolio do you see investors that of the original company and founders actually start getting paid?
So we've got an asset right now that we've been working on trading. And in that one, so the original debt will get made whole, like fully whole. And they were looking at, they had $5.5 million of senior debt that they were looking at basically a zero on. Mm-hmm. And so they'll get made whole. The original founder will get something. The VCs didn't roll over in that transaction. So the original founders got about 10% of common. You know, I would say they'll probably end up with, call it on a, like they'll probably end up with a couple, you know, couple million dollars by the time everything's said and done.
Kick in the face, right?
But yeah, but they basically handed us the keys and we took it over and we've been running it for 4 years.
Yeah. And then, so what's the involvement? Because obviously you're not going to repeat insanity. You know, you're not going to give the guy autonomy that ran the business into the ground. So like, how do you work with founders?
Yeah, this is something that's changed, I think, through our, like, over the years. Originally, we felt like we didn't need the founders. I think now we're looking for deals where we actually do really like the founder, that founder energy is still there and they want to continue, because it really does make a difference in an early stage tech company. Like that founder kind of just grit and determination is really hard to hire. We get all these, we get a lot of operating execs. They're like, oh, I could be an operating exec, come and turn around. It's really hard to be an operating executive in like a $3 billion SaaS company, right? Like you just need someone.
No, it's misaligned incentive. Like there's just no talent there, right? It's kind of barbelled. You know, my last firm, Canal Partners, I mean, we fired CEOs regularly, right? Or founders, I should say. And at the end of the day, I think it worked once, right? and that was like the second time that, you know, that it worked, right? It wasn't like the first guy, you know, worked.
Yeah.
It was the guy, the second hired gun worked.
Yeah.
And like, it barely worked. So I honestly feel that, and I'm, you know, I judge merit based on performance, right? And if a founder, like I don't, like in my current firm, I don't fire founders, not because I always think that, like, you know, they're the best person to run the job, but it's because it's just not worth it. You just can't find somebody that's motivated and the asset's not worth that much, right? To actually run it the way that they want to run it. And it's a diminished return. And you don't know if a hired gun's good until 9 months after.
Agreed. So where we're at, because we bring, I think what's interesting about our model is we operate like an owner. So we're coming in, we're providing the back office, we're taking their finance, their legal, their HR, and we're giving them someone from our portfolio manager that is working hand in hand with the founder. So as we look forward to the next fund, I think almost every deal, our goal is find a founder, get them properly incentivized, really get them excited about where we're going, but give them a very good, a very solid, almost think of it as like COO type, someone that is going to take a lot of the day-to-day decisioning off their plate, because it has proven difficult to get founders to really embrace like thinking about cash management, thinking about budgets. Like it's just not their natural state. It's not their natural state to every week be like, did we hit our number last week? No. Are we on track? No. All that.
That's very rarely do you see that Venn diagram kind of had the person of operator and founder. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
So talk your book. Like, what are some of the companies that you're excited about?
We have some great companies. My favorite right now, so Third Channel is just, you know, this one of the first companies we acquired. We actually just finished our second roll up. So we bought them, then we rolled another company into it, and then they just did another roll up. And that is a big part of our strategy that I think is unique in this early stage. Like there are not a lot of people in early stage private equity, period. And then those that are not necessarily really taking the roll up playbook. Cause you're talking about, you know, you have a $2 million tech company and you roll in another $2 million tech company. Like that is it makes a lot of sense, but it is hard. And so you really have to be creative.
People would do it. Yeah.
Correct. So, but what's interesting is it makes it a lot easier to get deals done because you say to the founder, look, yeah, you're going to take this hard deal, but then let's just go buy some of your other, they all know each other. They know who in their industry is not doing great. I'm like, how about we go acquire their company? Right. And so this growing, I think we're discovering that is something that we bring to the table as a private, because we have that expertise in house. All we do is M&A all day long. So right now we have 5 platforms in the portfolio, but we've done 13 acquisitions in the last 4 years.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. So
are you doing integrations or are you just kind of holding them as like individual?
No, full integration. So we're doing one right now where we closed on Verblio as our latest acquisition in fund 2. There's content platform and one of their competitors came to us a month after close and asked if we would buy their, buy them. So wow. we're in process now to be announced, hopefully knock on wood. But it's great.
And so how do you describe the asset class as it's kind of new, right? To the limited partner base. I mean, that's got to be an interesting story.
It's very hard. I think one of the biggest piece of like feedback we get from potential LPs is, yeah, what if the VCs don't want it? It must be bad. If it's broken, how can you really fix it? Like, how is this going to work? And the truth is it is very difficult. But we really, so I describe the asset class as I just call right now we're calling it just early stage private equity. You know, we were talking about distressed venture, you know, micro private equity, but there's no real name for it. I think now it's all just alternative venture, sort of general early stage. Yeah.
And if you're in like the distressed business, I mean, it's pretty yucky, I hear, you know, just from the later stage distressed, like special sit, you know, asset class. Like if you go,
guess it depends who you like, are.
Like those conferences are pretty grimy, you know? So
Yeah. I think it's got a bad rep because I think what makes us very unique as partner as general partners is, like, I was a founder, so I have run an early stage tech company, which your average distress technology investor has not done. Same with Ingrid. Like, we've just been around it a lot, and I think we bring a very unique perspective. And the cool thing about distress is all we're trying to figure out is, what is the true distress here? Is it actually a distressed asset, or is it just in a distressed situation? And people don't like to do that much work as investors, like to really sort through a deal, you got to lean in, you got to look at everything. And one of our, like, internally we talk about like what we really like doing. We really like finding value in the chaos. Like, I like chaos. People are like, this went wrong, and then this happened. I'm like, okay. But if you can just push all that aside and really see the good, there's an unbelievable amount of opportunity. And a lot of these found, and what's interesting is often you really have to listen to the founder, because good founders really understand where the value is in their business.
And you know, you might be missing the most important, like, silver lining of, like, they learned their lesson, right? And like,
yes,
you're throwing that, you know, you always hear like the best founders, the ones that have failed already once or twice because they've been hardened. Like, think about the horsepower you can get from somebody that's like, dude, okay, that didn't work. Like, you spent enough time looking at my cap table and you said, like, you leaned in and not leaned out.
Yeah.
You found something here. Like, that could actually be like a really great partnership.
Exactly.
Assuming the CEO is not, or the founder's not a psychopath, but
you never know. There are no guarantees there, but yeah, that, I think that's exactly the point, right? Like, these founders, this is effectively an acquisition and a second chance. And I think you're absolutely right. If you can say, they'll ask you, and that is a big tell for us. Sometimes I run into founders, I'm like, why are we talking? Tell me what went wrong here. And you get the founders who are like, my investors are assholes, and you know, it's all their fault, and they told me they would fund me and they didn't, and now I'm in this situation, and this is a really great business, but for my investors. We often feel like that is not the kind of founder we want to work with. Yeah. It's not a good answer, right? What you want is, okay, here's what I did. Here's what I think really happened. Here are the things I've learned. Here's what I want to do differently. Here's why I think if I had another year and $1 million, I could get us to this place. And that's what we want to fund.
So, seeing gobs of distress, right? And in your pipeline, what is the common characteristics in your mind of why startups fail?
Well, that was a good question. Look, I think parsing through one, I think some of it is just misalignment. Actually, a lot of the companies that we get into our portfolio, it's not that they failed per se, but they failed. There were a bunch of expectations on both sides: founder expectations, investor expectations, lender expectations, and those expectations were not met, and they were not managed properly through, like, call it the last 2 years. So you're now in a situation where it's really hard to go anywhere. Everyone's stuck. No one agrees what they are going to do, and no one trusts each other, right? The investors no longer trust the founder. Like, there's, and everyone is at a place where they're just trying to kind of, like, solve for their own problem, right? The founder is trying to solve for often their employees or just their own reputation. Investors are trying to solve for not having to take a zero on their investment. Lenders trying to get their capital back. And now, so I would say that is half the battle. And I don't know that there's anything you can do about that, because this is a very high risk asset class. Venture is an incredibly high risk asset class. And that by definition, they cannot all go. I do think there's a lot that could be done in the structuring so that, you know, one thing we see a lot of are people that said, you know, 12 months ago, we got an offer for $12 million and my VCs rejected it outright. And it would have given them maybe 1x and actually was a really good deal. And why didn't we take it? So I think really, you know, people have to just like, really, I think, especially in this environment, like, I think those offers have to be considered. And I think there does, on the investor side, I think the VCs have to just, you know, accept where they are and say, well, if I could just de-risk it now and I just take what I take, but I am able to just walk away, you know, that like waiting is not usually the answer. Everyone thinks in this early stage venture, if you wait, something great will happen. And in my experience, waiting does not yield a better outcome.
Yeah. Well, especially now, right? It's like, especially it's almost now. Like you waited too long. I mean, like if you're still waiting, you're delusional.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's no signal to state that there's going to be any type of like roaring comeback. At all.
Agreed.
And most smart people called that, and it's just people whose heads are in the sand that still stay there. So, but like from an operational perspective, is it, I understand how, like, why they can't get resolution, right? Because of misaligned incentives, but how do they get to the point where they get to misalignment? I mean, is it just overcapitalization, overscaling too quickly?
I think there's just not a lot of, in the end, it's not a culture of accountability, right? VCs are not showing up at board meetings being like, you said you would do this last month. Why isn't it done? What went wrong? Did this happen? Did you cut? What did you do, right? You didn't hit your growth number. And that, I think, is part of the problem. They're probably not doing that because they don't want to say profitability over growth. Because I will say, being in the market right now, trying to trade, like trying to dispose of assets, everyone still cares about growth. Yes, we're all talking about profitability, but actually buyers in tech want to buy growth. So the VCs are not wrong to keep pushing on it. The problem is that growth is taking a lot longer and they're not willing to go deep enough, I would argue, right? They're kind of getting, they're like, well, we put this much money in, we didn't see the growth we wanted. So now we're out.
We don't want to pay again for growth that didn't happen, right?
So. Correct. But growth is taking a lot longer. So, but I don't look, I would, do we run into companies where I'm like, oh, this was just very poorly run? Of course. Yeah. But is that the majority? No. It was like, we all agreed we would focus on growth. We made a bunch of bets. Those bets did not pay off. And now no one wants to take another bet.
Right.
That is really the problem.
And lack of
trust. And so now what? Right. And lack of trust.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a power law game. It's a power law game.
Yeah. Which I think is probably something that has to be looked at, right? Does it need to be a power law game? Like, could there be more incremental funding? I don't know that it's good. Like, I don't know that just giving, you know, these founders $20 million, like, have a good time. You know, we'll see you at a quarterly board meeting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think so. That's never been my deal, you know, but, you know, some, you know, and, you know, there's just a lot of noise and there's just a lot of bad advice, and bad advice can destroy your company. And
yes,
and I can understand why people hate investors. Like I hate myself. Right. So why wouldn't anybody else hate me? No, but it's easy to know why, like, we would be disliked, because we say one thing, we sit on an ivory tower, then we say another thing, and we have no empathy to, like, actually how to get there, because we look at benchmarks and not really at, like, operationally, like, what needs to happen. But, you know, if we knew how to do that, we would probably start companies and make a lot of money, right? we can't be good at everything. You know, we're really good at Excel and convincing people to take money, right? So, I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. One group needs the other group.
I agree with that. So, and I think we would not be in business without a whole bunch of venture. I'm effectively buying venture dollars at a discount, right? When you really distill the strategy down, that is what we are doing. So take away the venture dollars. I'm not quite sure what happens to our business model. So I by no means am saying, you know, venture's not, and I think there's a lot of technology that would never be funded if we didn't have it. But I think it could be managed differently, deployed differently.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of like companies that get venture dollars shouldn't get venture dollars. They should just get growth equity dollars.
Yeah.
Right. And like markets aren't that big. The demand isn't that big, but there's just the asset class is just flooded. Right. And when you're doing that, you just kind of get this. And now I'm seeing I'm even seeing growth equity saying like, yeah, a lot of these companies, they die at 10 million. Right. And we underwrote them to 50. So there's a fundamental problem here.
I agree. Like if anything, so we saw, so one of our LPs sent us like another kind of call it fund in our space saying, you know, I'm going to buy these early stage companies. And their point was, you know, you're going to buy these companies and we're going to find good companies where we're really hands-off as investors. And I would say that in my mind, if there was one thing about our strategy that I believe wholeheartedly, and I think applies to general early stage tech, it is actually having solid operators alongside these founders and as investors being sometimes kind of in the weeds and helping them make decisions on a day-to-day basis, I think delivers better outcomes. Teaching them and like being there, should we hire this person? What are they going to do? Why are we doing this? Like just that, it's not just governance, but call it real actual operational expertise, I think makes a huge difference.
Well, and those founders are first-time founders, like full stop, right?
Yes.
So you don't know what great looks like.
No, and then often what we're saying, well, don't worry, we hired this guy from Google, and we put him in the mix, and he was on his own, but like, I don't know that that's the answer that's either, the because answer. Often, though, yeah, those people don't necessarily, yeah. They've never then operated an early-stage company, so finding what is interesting about the called private equity model is you really are becoming a partner, right? We're sort of in this together. And I think it changes the dynamic in a very good way. I think there's certainly an argument to be made of, you know, maybe if these early stage companies are not doing well, just in venture, the answer might not, it might be more money, but it might be like money plus actual much closer oversight.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Versus just a check.
So Krista, what are you excited about over the next couple of years?
What am I excited about?
Besides your pipeline.
Besides my pipeline? I mean, look, I guess that is, I think it is very cool to be a fund in what I would consider an emerging asset class. And there's a lot to learn. And I think I'm very excited about sort of the expansion of our strategy, but also thinking about like, affiliate strategies, how do we get more people into this space? I think this whole conversation around how is there another way to make early stage tech companies successful? Is there another way to manage them, you know, other than the standard venture model? Like, I love that. And then I think also just some of the advances in technology, we are trying as a very startup fund to really be saying, okay, how are some of these late, you know, new AI tools going to change the way we invest, change the way we manage companies like that? You know, we're talking about like our technology roadmap as a fund, and that is pretty exciting. Yeah, it's really so. Yeah, look, I think, and that we're in a time of market shift, and I think times like this are fascinating. Mm-hmm. I do, and I think the investors, people who are actually. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. So you have a lot of people sitting on the sidelines. And I think those of us that are in the mix trying to figure out how to still deploy capital, even in this very uncertain environment, I think that's where opportunity is made. I think so. Absolutely. I'm happy to be there. Yeah, part absolutely. Of it. Yeah.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening to another episode of The Capital Stack. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, tell a friend, and we will see you next week because we drop an episode every week on Tuesday. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to The Capital Stack Podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing. David Paul is the founder and general partner at DWP Capital. All opinions expressed by David and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of DWP Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. David and guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed on this podcast.